From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, in for Doug Fabrizio. If you're reading the Bible as a treatise on how to live your life, you soon run into a stumbling block, the problem of divine violence. You can find God in the Old Testament protecting the weak and the orphan and commanding the slaughter of women and children. In the New Testament, Jesus tells his followers to love their enemies, but by the book of Revelation, he's leading the charge to destroy the earth. So will the real God please stand up? Is the nature of divinity violent or nonviolent? That's the question at the heart of biblical scholar John Dominic Crossan's latest book, and he comes down on the side of the nonviolent and fair God. He says it's a radical vision for the world, but that we've twisted the message for our own purposes. John Dominic Crossan is in Utah and joins us to explain what violence in the Bible teaches us about the civilization we've built after the news.
Hey there, podcast listener. This is Benjamin Bombard. I'm one of the producers of Radio West. Thanks for downloading this episode of the show. If you're a regular listener of the podcast, think about becoming a sustaining member of KUER. It's as little as $5 a month, and you can find out how to do that by visiting KUER.org. And thanks a bunch.
This is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. It's easy to walk away from an end-to-end reading of the Christian Bible, the Old Testament and the New Testament, with some confusion about the nature of God. On the one hand, he sends rain on the righteous and unrighteous alike. On the other, he's brought so much destruction to the world that blood runs as high as a horse's bridle for 200 miles. And this isn't a question of bad cop God of the Old Testament and a good cop God of the New Testament. Keep in mind that both of those examples come from the New Testament. So is God, and by extension Jesus, violent or nonviolent? It's the question renowned biblical scholar John Dominic Crossan struggles with in his latest book. And it's a question he wants to answer by using the text of the Bible itself, while understanding the time and place it was written. His book is called How to Read the Bible and Still Be a Christian, Struggling with Divine Violence from Genesis through Revelation. And he's joining us today to talk about it. You can join us as well. 801-585-9378 is our number. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. You can also join us on Facebook and Twitter. John Dominic Crossan is Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University in Chicago. He's written some 27 books on the historical Jesus, the Apostle Paul, and on early Christianity. Crossan is in Utah today to deliver the opening lecture of the 2015 Sunstone Symposium. We'll give you details about that as we go along. John Dominic Crossan, welcome.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Elaine. Live this time.
Live and in person. I mentioned your body of scholarship, and most of those books that you've written look at the historical Jesus. Early on in this latest book, you tell the story about the day that that actually became your focus and your interest focused in on that. It was at the Passion Play at Oberammergau in Bavaria in 1960. And I'm wondering if you can tell us that story. What struck you during that performance of the Easter story, and how did that inform your work?
So we're in 1960. In the fall of 1960, I got my doctorate in 1959, and my superiors, and I was in the 13th century religious order, a monk and a priest, they sent me to Rome for 2 years of specialized study. So it's 1960, it's the summer is coming on, Rome's going to be hot, the Olympics are coming, so Rome's in a bigger mess than usual for the summer. And my thought is, how do I get out of here? I get a letter from my, remember letters that used to come in the mail? I got a letter from my superior saying there is a group of American Catholics who are doing a tour of Europe, going to all the major Catholic sites. You are to proceed to Lisbon, meet them, and be their chaplain for 2 weeks. And I'm thinking, thank you, God, I'm out of here. So basically, we're going across Europe. I'm the chaplain. We have a guide, of course, as well. And since it's 1960, we come to Oberammergau. And every 10 years on the decades, they do a passion play. It takes about 6 hours in commemoration and gratitude for protection from a plague back in about 1634, I think it was. So imagine this giant hall. We're 9 o'clock in the morning. The first scene that's on the stage is what we call Palm Sunday. Jesus entering into Jerusalem, everyone's going, Hosanna, oh, everyone's for him. The whole stage is filled, and it's a giant stage. The auditorium looks like one of those giant sheds where the planes are maintained at a at the Air Force. Everything is for him. The whole crowd is for him. Then you come around, let's say 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you've had your lunch, and you're back in again, and we're now on Good Friday. And the same crowd, and it is the same crowd, you recognize the women and children.
The characters on the stage.
The characters are the same. There's 250, that's my guess. I mean, it packs the whole stage. It's a giant stage. And they're all shouting, "Crucify him." Now, I did know the story.
Sure.
It wasn't a surprise ending. But what struck me when I saw it as drama had never struck me when I read it, this text. This is not a very good story. I don't know what's going on. I don't know why the crowd that was all for him in the morning, 9 a.m. or Sunday, is all against him 3 p.m. Friday. What happened in between? If I was reviewing this as a story I'd never heard of before, I'd say, there's no explanation. What happened in the middle? Why did they all turn against him? Now, that had never struck me before. And the first scholarly article I ever wrote was called Anti-Semitism and the New Testament, because I recognized that when it was portrayed as drama, you could intensify with the music, for example. Mm. What music do you play when Caiaphas comes on? Is it ominous music? The dress. Does Caiaphas have a more elegant dress than Pilate? You could send all sorts of messages that aren't really in the text. You could make it in plain language much more anti-Semitic. And I was deeply aware that in 1960, obviously there was one in 1950 with Adenauer and Eisenhower present, and there was none in 1940. But Hitler had seen it in 1930, before he became chancellor, and in 1934 for the centenary, after he became chancellor, and had extolled it, reviewed it, and said this was splendid because it showed the superiority of the Aryan pilot over against, I'm quoting Hitler now, the muck and mire of Jewry. So I was very aware that this could play and intensify the anti-Semitism. So I began thinking, I don't want to make it sound as if I knew my whole destiny. No, there's something going on here that doesn't make sense, and I don't notice it in the text until I see it as drama. Then I notice it in the text. So I started to think about the historical Jesus. What had actually happened? What had happened that Friday, that Sunday? What had happened that week? And I started to think both historically and in terms of faith. So how does faith and history interact? And that was basically the genesis of what I've been doing ever since.
And you talk about in your book, like so much of the time of your academic research was focused on the historical Jesus rather than than on your personal faith.
Yes.
But it seems in this book that theology and history are being married to try to get it an answer.
That's exactly correct, because what happened for the first 20 years, say from in the 60s and 70s and even into the 80s, I was writing for my colleagues. I was writing historical criticism. What I thought about it or what they thought about it was not the issue. We were trying to do good history. And by the way, if you don't do good history, you're not going to get good theology. good history and you'll get better theology. Then what happened actually, after 1991, I published finally the big book I was working on, The Historical Jesus, Life of a Mediterranean Jewish Peasant. I began to get requests from churches to come and talk to them about the historical Jesus. Now, obviously, they were interested in it not only as history, but as faith. So that allowed me a venue, a constituency, where I could say, this is what I find as a historian, and this is what I believe about it as a Christian. And that happened because I was invited. It was not part of my program, as it were. I was invited to churches, and that has gone on since 1990 in round numbers.
So this historical Jesus is now informing the theological Jesus, but to do that, you have to go to other sources, non-canonical sources, yes, or to histories, Josephus or yes, Roman histories. And perhaps a more literal reader of the Bible might question that use. So I wonder, especially for unerring word of God, sort of readers of the Bible, how do you justify those other sources?
Well, in one sense, I justify it from the text itself. For those who can count, we have four Gospels. Or they would not say four Gospels. They would say we have one Gospel and four versions, because they call them the Gospel according to Matthew, Mark, Luke, John. They never say, I often say, the four Gospels. I don't think anyone in the first century would do that. So what you have is four vectors, versions on the same person. And they're unabashedly about it. All four of them are there. All you have to do is put them in parallel columns and read them horizontally. And you see, wait a minute. And it gets intensified if, with the massive consensus of scholarship, you accept that Matthew and Luke are using Mark as a major source, and you put these in parallel columns, and you can see, literally see, when Mark says this, Matthew changed them, and Luke changed them, and it doesn't look like they got new data, went to the archives, as it were. They're saying, in effect, for our people, this is the better way of understanding it. Unabashedly, we're getting four versions on the same person. So I'm watching those four vectors. And even as you said, there's other ones outside. But basically, for the moment, stick with the four. Mm-hmm. What is this historical Jesus they're all pointing at? They're all interpreting him. And I see nothing wrong with interpreting him. Or interpreting him differently for different occasions, venues, constituencies. But I'm asking an historical question. If you were there as a journalist in the first century, neither for Jesus nor against him, how would you explain why Pilate wants him crucified and Peter wants him sanctified? Why would you? How did that happen? How did two people look at the same person and come up with totally, he's a criminal, he's a Christ? So I'm asking that as an historical question. Then, as a Christian, I will say whether I think this Jesus is the light of my life, as it were. The dream of the world. You could, as a reporter, do your job, report on Jesus, and at the end say, I think he's absurd. I'm with Pilate. So a journalist has to be able to report what the person is saying and doing accurately. What they think about that person is a separate issue. If you were in a presidential campaign, and let's say you had a Republican candidate and your job was to report on the Republican candidate, you should be able to do that fairly, even if at the back of your mind you think, well, I'm a Democrat and I don't believe a word of this. If you can't, get out of it. Don't be a journalist. You're not a journalist. You're an editorial person. So I'm trying to do honest historical work on Jesus and then say whether I, as a Christian, believe in this vision that Jesus has. I have to tell you honestly, I've never found a serious discrepancy between what I find as a historian and what I believe as a Christian. But that probably is because I would know how to distinguish something literal from something metaphorical.
So you're using this sort of journalistic approach, maybe. Yes. We'll say historical approach, but I like this. I like this journalist metaphor to talk not just about Jesus, but to get to this question, you call it struggling with divine violence, right? In the Old and the New Testament, in the Christian Bible. And I've been using the word violent and nonviolent to talk about this, but I want to introduce a couple of terms that you use because we'll need them to sort of move forward in the conversation. And that is distributive justice as an idea for nonviolence and retributive justice as the idea for violence. Yes. Explain those two different terms, if you would.
All right, in ordinary everyday language today, at least in America, I find the term justice, now if used without any adjectival range, to mean retributive violence, retributive justice. If you see for a headline, justice for DUIs, I'm pretty certain I know what that means, that people are getting away with DUIs and there should be more retributive justice.
Punishment.
Punishment in plain language. So sanctions. Then we think about it for a second. The basic meaning of justice is distributive justice because you couldn't have retributive justice unless the punishments were distributed fairly. So when the Bible uses the term justice without any qualification, you have to think of it as distributive justice. That means how does whatever we're talking about get distributed fairly? And in the Bible, it is God's world. So the Bible talking about justice wants to know how is God's world. That is, it ain't our world. We're only stewards, managers, estate agents, as it were, for God's world. That said, in Leviticus, the land belongs to me. You're all tenant farmers and resident aliens. Probably not documented even. But what it means really is it's God's world and it is God's vision that the world be distributed fairly to everyone. That's called distributive justice. And that's what I want to insist on as the basic meaning of justice in the Bible. Because when a peasant, say in the Old Testament, cries out for justice, they're not really asking, please punish me appropriately. They're crying out for a fair share of the world, a fair deal, as it were, and they know they're not getting it. So justice in the Bible presumes the world does not belong to us, that it's not about almsgiving or our handouts, our charity, that the world belongs to God, and that everyone in God's people, which is everyone, has a right to a fair share. The model for the Bible is like family, where everyone has a right to a fair share of the family goods and responsibilities.
So we're going to dive down deep into that as when we get back from a break. John Dominic Crossan is with us. He's the author of How to Read the Bible and Still Be a Christian, Struggling with Divine Violence from Genesis through Revelation. Tonight at 7 o'clock on the campus of the University of Utah, Crossan is delivering the opening lecture of the 2015 Sunstone Symposium. It's the annual event of the Sunstone Foundation, a group that focuses on Mormon scholarship. His lecture is called The Kingdom Mind, From Jesus to Paul and the Implications for Mormonism. That event is free and open to the public. He's also speaking today at Benchmark Books at 12:30, so you'll want to get down there straight away after this conversation. He also has two presentations tomorrow as part of Sunstone. All the details are on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. We have to take a quick break. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, filling in for Doug Fabrizio. Here's a central question at the heart of the biblical scholar John Dominic Crossan's latest book. If you're a Christian, how do you know which God is your true God? The nonviolent fair God who sends rain on the righteous and unrighteous alike, or the violent God of retribution who would wreak so much destruction that flows rivers of blood? And this isn't the Old Testament bad cop God versus the New Testament good cop God. The violence and the nonviolence, the radical ideas of equity and love, you can find them from Genesis to Revelation. John Dominic Crossan says it's human civilization that has twisted the original message. Crossan is in Utah. He's speaking tonight as part of the 2015 Sunstone Symposium. We'll give you details about that later in the program. So turning to the Old Testament and trying to get at these ideas, I mean, this is as much a conversation about the nature of man as it is the nature of God. So I want to start here with the story of Cain and Abel, because it's a great microcosm of the arguments that you're making. Of course, the story is told in Genesis 4. It's about two brothers, the elder brother Cain, who's a farmer, and the younger Abel, a shepherd. So take the story from there, because you see it as a parable or a metaphor for the invention of civilization.
Yes, it is, first of all, and I'm speaking literally, the most succinct description of the Neolithic revolution, that is the revolution of the settled down life of farming, irrigation along the floodplains of great rivers like the Tigris and the Euphrates or the Nile or the alluvial floodplains. The domestication of grains, the domestication of animals, and with it goes the domestication and control of people. Hmm. Because once you've trained people willingly to do irrigation, because they all see how good that is for everyone, you also control them to do things like war and empire and everything else. So you could ask this question of people who know the Bible. When is sin, the word sin, singular, capitalized S as a word, when's it first used in the Bible? By whom? What context? What do you get from it? Most people would say, well, sure, that's an easy one, Garden of Eden. We all know about the fall and the first sin and everything else. And yeah, but it's not there. It's in chapter 4 that you just mentioned. Cain is the farmer and he kills the herder. And that's, of course, the core of the Neolithic revolution. And then Cain, by the way, builds the first city. So now we're right up to date. Farmer kills herder, builds first city. And in the long haul of civilization, the city will eventually kill the farmer, as we know.
Sure.
The city will eventually take over all the family farms, let's put it this way. But what's interesting in chapter 4 is Cain kills Abel, and you're expecting God to really punish Cain. I mean, shouldn't we? Come on, let's get this punishment. Let's have some retributive justice here. And what happens is God says, the land rejects you, Cain, because you have spilt innocent blood on it. The land rejects you. But then by the end of chapter 4, maybe five generations later, Lamech is boasting that I've already killed a man for striking me. And if anyone strikes me, my tribe, my clan, will take none of this sevenfold vengeance, but 70 times sevenfold vengeance. So as I read this short summary of the Neolithic Revolution, what I find is violence is escalating. It's escalating from one killing one to the spiral of violence, not in national wars, they haven't been invented yet, but in the blood feuds of the desert, where one kills one, my tribe kills two, four, six, eight, keeps escalating almost forever. So you have a parable of warning about civilization. Yeah, the farmer replaces the herder, the city is here. Violence escalates, and then you're left with this huge question that God warns Cain, sin is like a feline, a great beast waiting at the tent flap, ready to pounce. But you should be able to overcome it. God doesn't say, well, you can't do anything about it. You know, what can you do? Sin's so powerful. So there's no theory there that, well, sin just is more than we can handle. We are responsible for it. So the first time it's used, God warns that it's like any attacker, you should be able to overcome. But you have this warning of what I call the escalatory nature of violence. It's not just Cain kills Abel, Lamech kills somebody else. It's one-on-one, sevenfold, 70 times seven, all in one chapter. And that's the terrible inaugural warning of the entire Bible. Violence escalates. And I don't see it because we're getting more evil. I think, you know, we're getting better at everything. I rather do like my modern computer. If we're getting better at everything, then we're getting better at violence. Onto the point when it now threatens the world. We have the capacity, which certainly no ancient empire ever had, to destroy our world. Accidentally, maybe, or even deliberately.
You've just made the point that it can be overcome, as it were. Yes. But I think this is an interesting point that you make about that parable, that sin is at the tent flap. It's crouching outside the door.
Yeah.
So what does that tell you about human nature itself, that it's not an inevitability, it's not human nature, but you're placing this escalation of violence on civilization rather than on the nature of man?
Yeah. And then the aphorism I say to myself to summarize it, it is that the normalcy of civilization is not the inevitability of human nature. That we are not naturally born killers. One simple piece of evidence, if we are naturally born killers, we wouldn't have post-traumatic stress disorder. Nobody would have it. I don't think the Serengeti lions have post-traumatic stress disorder after a day of, you know, hunting and successfully killing gazelle. So I'm trying to make this distinction between human nature and human civilization, that we have grown used to the normalcy of violence. I don't mean that there's nothing going on in civilization but violence, but it is sort of built into that dangerous moment when instead of being able to move on if somebody else attacks us, we have to stay and defend. And we have to ask ourselves, wouldn't the safest way to defend our irrigated farms be to maybe have an empire or maybe a standing army? And then they protect us. We'd be safe. We'd be inside this cordon of protection. So empire is one of the midwives hovering over the birth of civilization. And we do call Iraq, that is Mesopotamia, between the Tigris and the Euphrates, the cradle of civilization. Not of culture. Culture was there for millions of years with human beings. But civilization is this invention of culture that happened along the alluvial floodplains of these great rivers.
So in the history of Cain and Abel, as you mentioned, God isn't the agent of punishment. God's not the one who says, I'm going to kill you, Cain. Cain's yes. worried about it. He says, no, I'm going to protect you from people killing you,
yeah.
right?
Mark you.
So God's not acting out retributive justice here. collapsed. But so let's look at an example of God's distributive justice. Okay. And you turn to Leviticus and the laws on land holdings, who gets what and what can or can't be sold. So what does that sort of legal distribution of in Leviticus of land look like? And what does that tell you about what you call the radicality of God?
Okay. Let me put one postscript to the Cain and Abel, because that just occurred
sure,
to me.
Yeah.
This is not in the Bible, but it's a legend, because a lot of people reading that story say, wait a minute, where's the punishment in here?
Mm.
Okay, the land rejects him, but come on, God, do your punishing thing. So there is a story, extra biblical legend, that Lamech, who is blind, is out hunting one day. And accidentally, so he's protected by accident, he happens to shoot at, he thinks, a beast in the forest. And guess who he kills? Cain. So the legend says, well, okay, there has to be retribution. But we don't want to say Lamech kills. That makes him a killer. So they're trying to come up with a non-violent form of violence that gets Cain punished. So
and again, God's not the agent.
God's not the agent. They're not ready to do that. It's extraordinary because Cain accuses God of being the agent.
Hmm.
But God says the land is the agent. The land has rejected you because you've infected it with innocent blood, and it's rejected you. But I'm marking you, so nobody will. So it's an extraordinary story, and I think we should read it far more carefully as, quotation marks, original sin, and not worry too much about Cain and Adam and Eve, because sin starts there. Now, come back to your question. In the book of Deuteronomy, we're using a term because it's in order to explain your relationship to God. Any person or group has to have some metaphor, some model, because it's not like another person out there. I can talk to you across this desk now. I can look in your eyes. I can watch you. I can't do that with God. So what model do I have of the relationship? The model to take is covenant. Mm-hmm. And covenant, of course, should be interpreted not the way we might do it today in a law course in the university, but what did covenant mean by the people who first used it? And covenant in those days was an agreement between usually a imperial overlord and a vassal state. And it involved two major things I'd insist on. One is the past history. What have I done for you that you should obey me? And the other, what's going to happen to you if you don't? So let's say history and sanction. And it depends where you put the emphasis. You could put the history of all the things I have done for you, and of course you're going to obey me, because how could you possibly disobey somebody who's so kind as me? Okay. Or
sounds like someone's mother. Right?
Sounds like somebody's mother. It's the imperial delusion that we're just here to help. You know, we're bringing you peace. But it is interesting because you can also go with sanctions. If you obey, all these curses, all these blessings will come upon you. If you disobey all these curses, and this is all invoked before God and before your gods and my gods, and it's a solemn covenant. It's like a heavenly charter, as it were. Now, in Deuteronomy, it's far more under the influence of the contemporary Assyrian charters, which are far, far heavier on the sanctions. Don't worry anything about our past history. If you don't obey, here's what's going to happen to you. And it goes on in indescribable things, verse after verse after verse, that terrify the living daylights out of you. Much more sanction than history, much more curses than blessings. Deuteronomy is coming out of that same matrix, that same contemporary period when the two superpowers of the Middle East, the Assyrians and the Egyptians, and poor little Israel is caught right on the road. It's like
smack dab in the middle.
It's like pitching your tent on an interstate and wondering why the trucks are hitting you from both directions. I mean, it's the most dangerous place in the ancient world. They're in the land route between the superpowers. And the international policy of Assyria is to take on Egypt. And they're coming right through. And they're going to take out the northern kingdom. They're going to take out the southern kingdom because you're just in the way.
But God's covenants are looking back, right?
God's covenants are looking back. But the contemporaries say Isaiah, when Isaiah is writing and he talks about covenant, he's watching very much the covenant, say, between Asher and the Assyrians, because they have their god Asher, who is saying all the same sort of things to them that Yahweh is to the Israelites. So Asher and the Assyrians, Yahweh and the Israelites, they both have covenants. But how are you going to explain the fact that every empire there's ever been comes through the Jewish homeland and devastates it? We must be doing something wrong. So the great biblical cry is, this must be God's retributive justice. We've been punished. So throughout the Psalms, Israel is crying out for mercy and forgiveness. But it's like telling the Irish that rain is a punishment from God. Invasion is not. It is not a punishment from God. It is simply the fact that they're living in the high road of empire. If Israel had spent their lives on their knees praying, if they were all saints, if they were all monks, the only difference is they would have been invaded and killed on their knees praying. So for me, it is a crime against divinity and humanity for the prophets to tell Israel, you're being punished for your sins. So it is the glory of the prophets to insist on distributive justice. No one has ever done it better. No one has ever done it more accurately. But when they say, and if you don't, you will be invaded, that is not true.
Because you give an example of one king who did well in the sight of the Lord and was killed in battle at 29.
Yeah, Josiah is one of the three model kings of the Old Testament. There's only three of them, actually. And he gets killed in battle. And they have a great problem explaining why, according to Deuteronomic theory, if you obey the Lord your God, all will be well. Your enemies will flee before you seven ways. He's killed by the archers in battle. And they work with the text and try and figure he must have done something wrong. So in the book of Chronicles, they say, well, maybe Pharaoh Necho was on a mission from God. And King Josiah interfered with God. Ah, so he got punished. So history is being adjusted to suit Deuteronomic theology and the theory of a covenant as reprisals, punishments, and everything else.
So you talk about a heartbeat of the Bible, yeah. Right? So here's God early on in Leviticus distributing the land equally, and when it's not to be bought or sold, and yeah. When it is, it has to go back. And so there's this sort of back and forth, and you see this in the prophets, right? So in Kings, Josiah, it's just the facts, right? He's yeah. killed. In Chronicles, now there's a big story to go around it. Talk about that heartbeat.
Okay. It's the metaphor I'm using of sort of the expansion contraction of a heart. I call it the assertion and subversion. For example, to take one from the Torah, God says in Leviticus, a book, by the way, that all Christians read regularly, of course.
Of course.
Very radical book, by the way. In chapter 25, God makes this astounding statement. The land belongs to me. You're all tenant farmers and resident aliens. The land can't be sold. You don't own it. Oops. That's no way to run free trade. That's no way to run a business, especially when you think of land as being the only capital in the ancient world. So I can't buy and sell land. So now people hearing that, they're not evil people. They're normal people. If I can't buy and sell land, how do I keep mine and get yours, since that's what civilization is about? We all know that. Ah, loans and foreclosures. I won't buy and sell. You're in trouble. I give you a loan. If you don't pay back your loan, I foreclose. It's called debt. Isn't that right, you might say? Along comes the Torah and says, yeah, yeah, but you can't take interest on debt. Oops. Let me rethink. All right. I can't take interest on debt, but I could still take penalties for default. This is how civilization beats God. So I give you your loan. You have no seed barley for next year. You're in trouble. I give you a loan until the next harvest. If you pay it back to me, we're free. But I'm betting you're probably going to be in trouble. And then I'll get your land. Didn't buy and sell it. No interest. So the radicality of God is constantly in the Bible, subverted. I'm not going to say by evil people, because that's not true. Because the same thing is going to happen to Jesus. Same thing is going to happen to Paul. It's the normalcy of civilization that we're inside. And it's been fought out in the Bible. It's not like the Bible is all the good stuff and then the bad stuff's out in the world. The honest contest, the integrity of the Bible for me, is that it still gives you, here's what God says. Here's God's vision. Now, kind of like, here's how we got around it. here's God's vision again. Here's how we got around it. So when you look in the Bible, it's like looking in a mirror. You see yourselves. That's what we do. We have this enabling vision of a just world, a world at peace, that we all love, of course. But we constantly work to make certain it doesn't happen.
Well, when we get back from our break, we'll see how we try to wiggle out of it in the New Testament. John Dominic Crossan is with us. His book is called How to Read the Bible and Still Be a Christian. He's in Utah for the 2015 Sunstone Symposium, and tonight at 7, he's going to give a talk called The Kingdom Mind, From Jesus to Paul and the Implications for Mormonism. It's in the Open Student Union at the University of Utah. It's free and open to the public. There's details on that and other events, including a reading today at 12:30 at Benchmark Books. All that's on our website, radiowest.kuer.org. And we do have to take that other break. We'll be back shortly. This is Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Elaine Clark, in for Doug Fabrizio. Our guest today is the renowned biblical scholar John Dominic Crossan, whose latest book takes on this question: is the nature of God violent or not violent? And what does the answer tell us about ourselves? The book is called How to Read the Bible and Still Be a Christian. He's in Utah, and he's joining us to talk about his book. And you can join us as well, 801-585-9378, or you can send us an email, radiowest@kuer.org. So we were talking about in the Old Testament, sort of the historical text and the textual proof of these arguments that you're making of a radical, nonviolent God. And you turn in early parts talking about the New Testament to the Sermon on the Mount and to Matthew 5. And you quote, of course, from that, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you so that you may be children of your Father in heaven. Be perfect, therefore, as your Heavenly Father is perfect. So you see in this passage not only Christ's nonviolence, but that sort of antecedent nonviolence in God and that relationship between Christ and God. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, and for Christians, of course, your faith is that Christ is the image of God. It's Christ is what God looks like in sandals, as it were. Nobody has seen God, but you look at the life of Jesus, and that's the lens through which you see God. So, of course, it's very important. If Jesus is violent, then God is violent. If Jesus is half violent and half nonviolent, then that's the image of God. But in Matthew, for example, inaugurally in his great opening sermon that Matthew puts up there together, we call it the Sermon on the Mount. It would be better to call it the New Law from the New Moses on the New Mount Sinai. It's much more important than a sermon on a mountaintop. You don't call people names. You love your enemies. You pray. All of that is quite clear. But later chapters, the same Jesus in Matthew is calling people hypocrites, brood of vipers. You're going all to hell, most of which is calling people names. Now, my point is not that Matthew, of course, is in conflict, say, in the 80s and 90s of the first century, with what I would call a Christian Jew, maybe even a Christian Pharisee, and he's in severe debate with non-Christian Pharisees. And I've no doubt they're all calling one another names. That's not my problem. Ancients were as good as we are at presidential debates of really going after one another. But when Matthew does it, it's Jesus who does it for him. Matthew doesn't say, I'm mad at you people and I think you are going to hell. He says, Jesus said it in the 30s, as it were, at the end. So all of a sudden, I have a problem. Jesus says, don't do it in early chapters of Matthew. Jesus does it himself in later chapters of Matthew. My question, does Jesus change his mind? Or does Matthew change his Jesus? And that's the entry into it. Does Jesus change? For example, he rides into Jerusalem on a donkey to lampoon, actually, the whole idea of Pilate coming in on his war horse as a Roman conqueror. He lampoons it. He makes a joke of it. It's a demonstration, an anti-demonstration. All right. So the Messiah enters Jerusalem on a donkey, like in Zechariah 9, to make peace. And a donkey, possibly even on a little female nursing donkey with her colt trotting along at her side. It's almost like a joke. men don't ride nursing donkeys. Not if they want to enter the gates of a city as a quotation marks conqueror. But then I get to the book of Revelation, where Jesus is coming back on a war horse to lead the angels and destroy all the evildoers. So again, I'm asking my question. Did Jesus Christ change his mind, as it were? Was the incarnation declared to be a failure? And there is, as it were, using a word that never appears in the Bible, a second coming to get it right? Have we given up on the incarnation and gone with the apocalypse? Or are we doing the same thing to Jesus that happened to God talking about the land? Assertion, subversion, expansion, contraction. We're hearing again the heartbeat of the Bible and its integrity, that it gives us God's vision and then tells us how to get around it. So don't worry about the incarnation when Jesus is all into this peace and loving your enemy stuff, because he's coming back with the
angels. This time with a vengeance.
To do it right. if you think about it, we have repudiated the incarnation. We've repudiated the Christian faith that Jesus is the image of God, or he's kind of, it's a schizophrenic God and a schizophrenic Jesus, or at least a bipolar Jesus. And I think the pattern that explains it for me is throughout the entire Bible. Same thing will happen to Paul. You get this assertion of a divine vision, the logos, the vision of God from the world from all eternity, which is a vision of a world distributed fairly, and because it's distributed fairly, there will be no violence. And therefore there will be peace, as it were, first justice, then peace. And we don't quite want that. Not because we're evil, but because there's another pull, which I call civilization, because it really started with the dawn of civilization in Mesopotamia, and that comes into the Bible. I think we are now at the point we have to say, well, which are we going to live by if we are to have a future as a species? Because it's not just that violence is like a little bad weather, you know, get used to it, stop whining about it. Violence tends to escalate. And if I was looking at it as a graph, I'd draw it like going straight up, you know, coming along for years without any, very, very nasty, but not threatening the world. The Roman Empire couldn't even threaten the Mediterranean. You know, couldn't even cut down the olive trees if it wanted to. So now we can do that. There's individuals who can do it even. There's groups who can do it. We have everything in place to destroy the world. We're just kind of crossing our fingers that nothing goes wrong. So my hope, coming from it as a Christian, but also coming at it from my experience of human evolution, is that we can get to the state that's saying we can no longer afford violence, in the same way that we got to the point of saying slavery or racism or sexism or all the other isms, even if they're still around, they're not right. We're kind of at least embarrassed by them. We're not going to say, well, it's nature, you know. Violence and the presumption that violence is the solution has become too dangerous to consider. And I'm getting that personally from two vectors. One is listening to Jesus, which I think is a correct vision. But I'm also getting it almost independently from human evolution, from what we've gone through in the last 10,000 years. And it's the escalation of violence.
You call the book of Revelation a libel.
Yeah.
The metaphor. Yeah. The metaphor that's presented in the book of Revelation, a libel against the Godhead.
It's against God, because I either have to say God changed that somehow this vision, which as a Christian, I think Jesus is the image of God, the Lamb of God, the Word of God, the Logos incarnate, all of that as a Christian means that my best chance of seeing God is through Jesus or with the Spirit of Jesus, two ways of saying the same thing. Now, I look at Jesus. I look at Jesus as a historian, and I find he's nonviolent. I find it as clear, for example, that Pilate executes him publicly, which tells me he's a revolutionary, but doesn't round up his closest followers, which tells me in the judgment of this Roman governor, Jesus is a nonviolent revolutionary against Roman law and order. I think Pilate got it exactly right. Now, as a Christian, I look at that judgment and I say, on the other hand, I think Pilate got it right from the Roman point of view, but not from God's point of view. That Jesus is, for me as a Christian, the image of God, the best way I can imagine God, which means that God is nonviolent. So the way I understand it, that I watch a pattern in through the Bible in which this vision keeps coming back and back and back again. It won't go away, thank God. And then you can watch people getting around us. And that's us. It would be nice to say, well, they were all evil people. Mm. We're not like that. It's the normalcy of civilization against the radicality of God.
Most of the time when we're reading a book or watching a film, right, we're reading it from beginning to end, right? The beginning, middle, and end. That's the way a story works. But you suggest reading the Bible differently. Revelation isn't the climax and the conclusion. Jesus is at the center. Talk about how you're thinking about reading the Bible, with the middle being the climax, right?
And that, in a way, makes it the strangest story ever told, because you're quite right. If you're reading a book and the last 10 pages are missing, you're going to scream. You're watching a movie and the last 10 minutes goes. You want to find out how it ends to get the meaning. Now, in this case, I think the meaning is in the middle. The climax is in the center with the historical Jesus, because Jesus is the norm of the entire Bible, the criterion, the lens, the glasses through which you read the entire thing. And where I saw that most clearly was in a metaphor. In walking into any of the great basilicas in Rome, any of those early medieval churches that followed that, all the way around on both sides of you, you spiral around the whole Old Testament, the whole New Testament. But zap, your eye is trained straight to the center in the apse where you have Jesus. He's not just part of the story. You can go all the way through, you know, his miracles, his birth, his miracles, his parables, his death, resurrection. And then what you get up here is not just the book of Revelation, but Jesus. So I began to imagine a metaphor, the kind of iconic metaphor, in where your eyes are guided architecturally and by art to see the story, to read the whole story. It starts with God creating up there in the top right-hand corner, for example. And then over there in the bottom left-hand corner, you'll have the last scene of Jesus, the resurrection or something like that. But smack in the middle in the apse is Jesus. Your eye is guided to the middle, not to the end. So the kind of the slogan I came up with for myself was, read the Bible verbally, but imagine it visually. Imagine it iconically.
Like a painting.
Like a painting, where your eye is always guided. If it's a painting, say, of the birth of Jesus, the nativity, Mary with the child won't be up there in the corner. The magi would be looking down, the shepherds, with angels, Joseph would be looking up. But your eye will be guided to what is the most important thing here. And I think we have to read the Bible iconically. Your eye is guided to the center.
But for all of this argument that violence is sort of comes from man and nonviolence from God, you say we need both the violence and the nonviolence in the Bible. You know, that if it were just all good cop enthusiasm from God, it'd be utopia and nobody would pay attention. Yeah. Talk about that tension. You say we need them both. You're not going to jettison one for the other, are you?
I suppose if I was in cold blood, I wouldn't have designed the Bible the way it is. I probably wouldn't have had four Gospels either. Give people like me a job. What I have to face is that if it was simply a beautiful vision of peace on earth, and those are there, then we could dismiss it. It kind of would be like, I don't know, I'm from Florida, so maybe Disney World. You'd visit it and say, yeah, but you can't live there. What you have in the Bible, though, is a vision that's both articulated and subverted. And I think we're looking deep into the heart of ourselves when we do it. So I've spent my life with the Bible. I think it is profoundly accurate, because it gives us God's vision and it asks us to watch ourselves beating it. And we're very good at it. We really are very good at it. You can watch it. I mean, the Second Coming is a huge invention. So I think it makes us face ourselves. It's like looking into a mirror, and you mightn't like what you see, but you have two clashing visions. And they're tectonic visions, as it were. They're the tectonic plates of human history. And we're asking, maybe we're the last generation that can ask it, which of these two visions is going to use a very biblical word, save us? And I mean that. We're talking about this earth. We're not talking about emigrating off to heaven. We're talking about what can save us if we continue to presume the normalcy of violence and violence keeps escalating. Will we have a future as a species?
You in the book with a reflection on love and justice. Is that the key then? Is love the engine for this sort of justice that you're talking about? Or what's that relationship?
Yes. I'm thinking of a very simple thing. Every time we look at, say, a little ant running across your kitchen sink, we can see something. We see an external something. We don't see the life force within it, but we know there's something there. The universe is expanding. We can see certain things, but there's a force within it. So call it outside and inside. Call it body and soul. Call it Einstein would call it something different, but outside and inside. I'm trying to imagine a human being, we say, is body and soul, flesh and blood. A human being dies. There's a separation, we say, of body and soul. Well, we don't get two separate things. We get a corpse. So I'm imagining justice, that is, distributive justice is the body or the flesh of love. And love is, in your, what you just said, the metaphor, the engine, the force that drives it. You could say, well, why should I bother? You know, I've got mine. I want to keep mine and get more and tough on you. There's a force within us, which I'm going to call love, which cannot be separated from justice. If you separate them, you're going to get a corpse. So if you're talking about loving everyone and there's no justice, then you're talking about an embodied, you're talking about a ghost. You're talking about a corpse. So justice is the body of love, and love is the soul of justice. Justice is the flesh of love, and love is the spirit of justice. Keep both or you get neither.
John Dominic Crossan, Professor Emeritus of Religious Studies at DePaul University. His latest book is called How to Read the Bible and Still Be a Christian. Tonight at 7 o'clock, he's delivering the opening lecture of the 2015 Sunstone Symposium. He's also giving a reading today at 12:30 at Benchmark Books. Just go to our website, radiowest.kuer.org, for all the details. John Dominic Crossan, thank you very much.
Thank you, Elaine, very much for having me.
Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Daniel Lombardi. The show is produced by myself and Benjamin Bombard. Our executive producer is Doug Fabrizio. I'm Elaine Clark.